beauty of trees and so on and so forth, right? But in addition, since we mentioned already one good teaching, so we'll mention another good teaching. Since we mentioned two good teachings, let me give you a third
one. That's where the torches come up.
Right. Okay. That's how the torch comes in. Exactly. Okay. So now we have another teaching. Aviyamarav Zutu Batuviyamarav. Okay. He also said in the name of Rav, Viyamri Law. But there are those who say, Omar Rav Chona Bar Bizna, Omar Rav Bishimon Chasida. That this tradition is not, you know, from Rav Zutar Bar Tuvia in the name of Rav, but rather it is Rav Chona Bar Bizna who said in the name of Rav Shimon, the pious. The Yamri Law, and there are those who say, no, he was not the original one to make this statement, but rather Omar Rav Yochanan Mishim Rav Shimon Yochai. Rabbi Yochanan said, Rabbi Shimon Yochai. Of course, the answer is that probably all of them like to quote this particular thing, but since we always like to try to find the original source of a statement, this is why they go back, not this one, but I have the tradition that it was this one who said it. No, I have a tradition that this was said much earlier by so-and-so. So this is the way it works. Okay. So, now what is this tradition? A very beautiful statement. It says, Noach loli Adam, it is better for a human being, Sheyapil Atzmo Leso Kivshan Hoesh, that he should throw himself into a fiery furnace, the Yalbin Pinei Chaveiro Barabim, and he should not cause someone, you know, to be disgraced, or, you know, to shame someone. He should not shame someone, Barabim. Barabim means publicly. Should not shame a person. Minala, how do we know that this is so? That a person should be willing even to throw himself into a fiery furnace, but not to bring shame to another human being publicly. So he says, Mitamar. We learn this from Tamar. The Tamar that we're talking about is the Tamar in the Torah. Who is she?
She's the Tamar is the sister of Was she the one that was raped?
No, that wasn't Tamar in the Torah. This is Tamar that you're talking about. Is Tamar in the Naf, you know,
okay.
The Bible, right? We're talking about she was a daughter of King David. Yeah, and she had a half-brother from two different mothers, but, you know, the same father, by the name of Amnon, and he raped her, correct? Okay. But this is not the Tamar that we're talking about.
Okay.
We're talking about the Tamar in the Torah, who was the daughter-in-law of Judah.
Okay.
Do you remember that incident where she married a son of Judah?
Yes, and he was
right.
Yeah.
And you know,
and
he died.
She disguised herself
first,
as a harlot.
You know, she wanted to to have, you know, a yobam, as we would say. In other words, you know, the brother-in-law marry her so she could bear a child and so on and so forth. But each one of them, you know, they did dirt to her, okay? So they all died, and then she decided, you know, she was desperate, so what did she do?
You know, she disguised herself as a harlot.
Right.
And met Judah in the
right.
in the marketplace.
Judah saw her, right, when he was busy with the sheep shearing, right?
He slept with her, and...
Yeah. Correct.
And he gave her his staff.
Hold it. Correct. Absolutely right. All right. First of all, you know, he slept with her, right?
Yeah.
And he says, you know, what shall I offer you? You know, as so she said, you know,
the staff and the garble, I think.
And the garble, right? Okay. Correct. All right. And then what happened after that?
And she became pregnant.
She became pregnant, and then, after about 3 months had passed, people began to notice that her stomach was getting a little bit on the big side, right? It was already beginning to swell. And so, immediately they accused her of having committed harlotry.
Yeah.
Right, harlotry.
Yes.
It's nudimus, the Hebrew expression that the Torah uses, okay? And Yehuda, the big shot, what did he say?
He disclaims her. He tells her she's.
Well, first of all, she didn't reveal that it was Judah.
That's right.
She didn't reveal. Okay, but when he saw that she was, you know, pregnant, and he saw that, you know, and he knew that it had to be as a result of harlotry, so he says, Hotziyuha b'sisarev. Take her out and let her be burned. Let her be put to death by burning. Okay? So as she was going out to be burned, to be executed, she says, a man who made me pregnant gave me these things, right? But she didn't name him. She did not name him. Because she did not want to
shame
him in public. He, of course, you know, when he saw these things, then he realized, you know, that he had wronged her because he had not done the right thing to her. And, you know, he confessed, you know, that he was the one who was the responsible party for it and so on. So from that we learn two things. First thing that we learn then is what we see over here, that she was willing
to cast herself
to be burned, but not to shame him in public, not to reveal that he was the father of her children, because eventually she gave birth to twins, if you remember.
That's right.
Peretz and Zerah, okay? And the second thing that we learn is this. From Judah we learn also that a person should be honest, and if he has done wrong, he should be willing to confess his wrong. As a matter of fact, the name Yehuda itself, it's interesting if we examine the etymology. His mother called him Yehuda because of the fact that she says, Hapam Odes Hashem, I will give thanks unto God because now I have born unto my husband four sons. You know, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, and he was number four, Yehuda, okay? So it's derived from the idea of giving thanks. As we say, you know, like Todah and Modani and Modamanafullah, I mean, all this represents giving thanks, okay? And so she called him Yehuda because of her thankfulness. But you know that the word Modeh in Hebrew has another meaning, a secondary meaning, and that is confess. It's interesting. So that he was Modeh, in this particular case, he confessed, you know, the wrong that he had committed. So this we learn from here, and we see, of course, you know, in an age where people are so busy slandering each other, and where the papers are full of all kinds of things, you know, that one person says about another, and I don't have to tell you, I mean,
negative.
Right. I mean, we hear, you know, also not so long ago, when we were reading Parsha Tazria and Mitzvah, we're talking about also that slandering another person. It's almost virtual to committing murder because you're taking away his good name, even as Shakespeare said in a later period, and so on, right? In such an age, I think we really have to revive this teaching to know how important it is not to shame a person in public, that we should always have regard for another one, be sensitive to the feelings of other people, and treat them like mention. Treat them as we ourselves would want to be treated under the circumstances.
Even if they've done wrong or something.
Yes,
like that.
Right. Doesn't mean that you cannot correct the person. We've been talking about that too. I mean, the rabbi was talking about the law in the Torah, Hocheach Tochiach HaSamisecho, that you should rebuke your neighbor, but under what circumstances? When you feel that it would be helpful, when you do it in such a way that you don't shame him and things like that. So, then there's a right way to do it. But, you know, to do it, you know, the way you cause a person shame, this is the wrong way. Okay, let's continue. Tana Rabbah, now we get back again to the business about different fragrances. Okay, Hevi'u lefanov shemen v'hadas. Okay, this of course goes way, way back, because who are the people who are discussing it? It's the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, which means that this is even a couple of centuries prior to the common era, okay? And this was the question. They bring to a person who's been eating, right? He's finished his meal, and they bring him shemen. Shemen, if you remember, is oil. And hadas, this is myrtle. Now, why these two things? So the answer is, the shemen is, as Rashi explains, it's there so that the person can wash away, you know, the filth on his hands. Remember again, they didn't have knives and gobbles and things like that in those days. They ate with their fingers, that's all. Mm. So naturally,
like
they ate with their
bowl.
Fingers, their hands, so yeah. And this, of course, we saw. We spoke last week about buying Machronim, if you remember.
That's right.
Right?
Right.
How did they get rid of the, the grease on their hands? So the answer is they would bring him a little olive oil. He would dip it in, put it on his hands, and so on, and that way he would remove it. Okay, wash it off. The hadas was because it was fragrant, so that he would smell. So it's to give him a good feeling, as we said just a few moments ago. Let the neshama also have a little bit happiness and smelling something sweet and fragrant. Okay, so they bring him these two things. They bring him oil and they bring him myrtle. Beis Shammai Omrim, so Beis Shammai says, Mevorech al Hashem. First you have to make the bracha for the oil, for the olive oil. V'yachar kach, Mevorech al Hadas. And then you have to make the bracha for the myrtle. Okay? All right. Now, okay. Beis Hillel, usually when Beis Shammai says one thing, what do we find? We find that Beis Hillel says the opposite, right? So it's no different over here. They say little omrim, and they say mevorech al hadas. First, you have to make the bracha over the myrtle. The achakach mevorech al hashem, and after that, you make the bracha over the oil. Okay. Take a look at the Tosfos for a moment at the top of the page over here. It says shemen v'hadas. He says, "Hi shemen, this oil." He says, "Is the hariachu. This is only for him to smell." This is what he says over here, Tosfos, okay? In other words, Tosfos disagrees with Rashi in this particular case, all right? Which happens all, by the way. Because he says, because if it is, in order simply to remove the grease, the dirt that has accumulated, then he says, so we say in a later chapter, in distracted, it says for that you don't make a bracha. So we're talking about the fact that they brought him olive oil which had a fragrance, and then also the hadas. So the question is, which do you consider, in other words,
the prime one,
right? I mean, this goes back to the old problem, you know, of what exactly do you give priority to. And one of the criteria that we learned is that, among other things, that which is chaviv alecha, you know, that which is beloved by you, what you personally prefer, you can make the bracha on that first. I mean, there are differences of opinion about that, as we saw, but nevertheless, this was one of the standard rulings that we had. Okay. So the question over here is, okay, what do you consider more important? Now, Beis Shammai, obviously, what do they consider more important? Since they say that it's the oil, then you have to assume that they felt, you know, that takes priority, right? And the hadas is only secondary. Whereas with Beis Hillel it was just the opposite. They say mevorech al hadas, mevorech al hashem. Okay, ganzma. Amar Rab Gamliel, so Rab Gamliel came along and he said, on the achriya, he says, I'm going to make a decision. I'll tell you how, in my eyes, I think, you know, we should decide. He says, shemen zochinu l'recho, zochinu l'sichoso. He says, in the case of oil, he says, we not only enjoy its fragrance, but we also enjoy using it as a lotion. Okay? So in other words, it has two benefits as far as we are concerned. Hadas, but as far as the myrtle is concerned, l'recho zochinu, yeah, we enjoy the fragrance of the myrtle, the sichos or no zochinu, but we do not get anything out of the taking myrtle and rubbing it, because that doesn't produce the same thing. So in other words, there's only one thing, and therefore, what do they say? What is Rav and Gamliel's reasoning lead us to? That we should decide according to whom?
According to Shammai.
According to Beis Shammai, exactly. Okay. Because they said that first the Shaman and then the others. Okay. And not only that, but Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, "Halacha kedivrei hamachria." He says that the halacha follows these words of the man who made the decision, namely Rav and Gamliel. He decided that this is the way it should be, so he said, "Halacha taka follows him." God's fine. So we think that we're all settled with this.
No, God.
No. Noch nicht. Rapapa, Ikla Leve Rav Huna, Vereda Rav Ikla. Says Rav Papa happened to come, you know, we came on a visit to the house of Rav Huna, the son of Rav Ikla. So Aisut Kamayhu Shem Hadas. Obviously, they had a meal, and then at the conclusion of the meal, they brought to them oil in Hadas, right? Oil in Breton. Shakal Rav Papa. So Rav Papa took the Richa Hadas Bereshon. First, he made the Bracha for the myrtle. Bahador, and then after that, Borich Hashem, and he made the bracha for the oil. Okay. So, Omalei, so in that particular case, Rav Huna said unto him, Lo Sova Lomar, don't you believe that the halacha kedivrei hamachriya, just as we said a few moments ago, that the halacha follows that of Rav Gamliel, who made a decision in favor of Beis Shammai? So, Omalei, so he said unto him, Rava said, Halacha Beis Hillel, right? That Halacha follows Beis Hillel. Velohi, but they say, well, yes, no, but at any rate, Lashtumute Navshe Hudeova. He wanted to get out of it. However, from the point of view of Halacha, who do we normally follow? Beis Shammai or Beis Hillel? Right. So that in almost all cases they try to find justification that the halacha follows Beis Hillel, and this is no exception to it. So if we happen to have both of them served to us for fragrance, as Tosfos taught us, then in that case, first to make the bracha for the shemen, which would be, of course, Morei Atzei B'Shamin, B'Shamin, right? We praise God for having created the tree that gives us such fragrance, right? And then the next one, the hadas, simply Morei what?
For the hadar, we
would say Isbay in this particular case, in order to have to, because if in the same bracha for both, then you could say, I want to conclude both in the same bracha. Okay? This is possible. Okay, so let's see. We'll just finish up right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tana Rabbanan, yeah. And we have another statement. Okay, right. Tana Rabbanan, Heviel if they have Shemin V'yayin. Now, here the question is not about oil and myrtle, but it's oil and wine. Okay. Beis Shammai Omrim, so Beis Shammai say, Ocheis Hashemin Bimino, he should take hold of the oil in his right hand, the Esayayim Bismolo, and the wine in his left hand. And then, first, what does he do? Mevorech Al Hashemin. First, he has to make the bracha for the oil. Bechozer Mevorech Al Yain, then he has to make the bracha for the wine. And guess what Beis Hillel are going to say?
The opposite.
They're going to say the opposite, right. Beis Hillel Omrim, he says, no. Oches is Hayayim Bimino. He has to hold the wine in his right hand. The Yes Hashemin Bismolo, right? And the oil in his left hand. The Vorech Al Hayayim. First he makes the bracha for the wine. The Chosim Vorech Al Hashemin, right? And then he makes the bracha for the oil. The Tocho Berosh Hashabosh. This is interesting. After he's already, washed his hands, so to speak, with the oil and gotten the food off, the grease off, so he puts it on the head of the shamash. Who's the shamash? The shamash is the man who's serving the meal. He puts it on, in other words, he puts it, So the question is, why? Why does he do that? Well, the answer is he doesn't because of the fact that as a Talmud Chochem, he should not go out with greasy hands. But the Shamish, therefore, so what if the Shamish is Talmud Chochem? Who? What if he is? Then in that case, Tocho B'Koysel. He smears it on the wall, not on the Shamish. Why? If they Sheganai la Talmud Chochem, because it is a disgrace for a Talmud Chochem, the Shem, the Dabzik Sherman, if a Talmud Chochem, Lot says Lashuk, if he goes out to the marketplace, Kishehu Mugusom, when he is smelling of spices or incense and so on. In other words, a man should not go out perfumed, but a man, particularly a Talmud Chochem, should not go out perfumed, because that's considered the meaning, it takes away from his manliness or from the aura of Kedusha or something, that he should be radiant. Okay, we will stop at this particular point. We recite a Kaddish Rabbanan.
This is
and next week, if Yirtzeh Hashem, we shall continue.
This is Mem Gimel.
We're now on Mem Dalet. Oh, let's do it. You're right. We're still in the bottom of Mem Gimel.
Mem Gimel.
Already thinking ahead.
Ahmed Beis.
Ahmed Beis, right. Okay. We're still there. Yeah. We are. Okay, I'll tell you where we're going to start right now. I just want to make one remark about one thing that at the end of last week. We are. Okay, you see where the long line begins. Okay? Count up from there. One, two, three, four, five. Okay? Starts, you see, the fourth, you have an abbreviation to the rabbon.
Right.
So that's where we'll start. However, I just wanted to say one thing. Remember, the last business that we had dealt with also, you know, whether if he holds wine and oil. So in which hand should he hold it? And we saw, and we saw at that time that the text says, that what is in the right hand is the one that he makes the bracha for first. Now, from this, of course, we learn something else, and that I didn't have time to mention last week. It's simply this. If we make a bracha, we should more correctly hold first. Say we make a bracha of a wine, making kiddush or something like that. We should hold it in our right hand rather than in our left hand. Okay?
Assuming you're right then.
Yeah, correct. Right. And the same thing, for example, you're making Abdullah, first you hold, the wine in your right hand, and then after that you take the incense and you hold it in your right hand. Okay? So, normally a bracha should be made holding that object that you're making the bracha for in the right hand, because that's considered the more important thing, and therefore you're putting, greater emphasis on it. Okay. So that's an aside. All right, now we'll continue with the story of the poor shamas. Not really the shamas, but the business about the perfuming. Okay? Yeah. All right, so we start with Tana Rabbanan. Tana Rabbanan, we have tradition, our rabbis taught, that Shisha Devarim Genailo the Talmud Chacham. There are six things that are disgraceful for a Talmud Chacham. What are they? So the first thing that he mentions is Al Yetzei Keshub Mefusam Lashuk. Okay? First thing is that he should not go out perfumed, to the marketplace. Of course, to the marketplace means any place in public where he's going to be. He should not go out smelling from perfume. All right? Second thing, the al yetzei yechidi balayla. He should not go out alone at night. Third, the al yetzei b'minolim ha-metulayim. Also, he should not go out with shoes that have been patched. We'll see what all these refer to in just a moment, okay? And the fourth one is V'yayasapim Isha Bashuk. He should not engage in idle conversation with a woman in the marketplace. Okay? In other words, in the public place, don't, okay? Don't spend too much time talking to women. The next one, V'yal Yisov V'chavura Shalom Yehoretz. Which means, you see over here, it's the same thing that we had, like Nesubin and so on. In other words, don't attend a dinner in the company of Amorites. People who are Amorites. Okay, why not? We'll see in a second. Okay?
Amorites meaning ignorant people.
Yeah, ignorant people, or in the more technical sense, if you remember, the Am Haaretz or the Ame Haaretz, they were the people who did not observe the same strict rules of purity that the Purushim, that the Pharisees did, that the Chachamim did in general. Chachamim were Purushim, okay? So that in their own personal life, they tried to live up to the highest standards of purity. And the Amei Haaretz did not. They did not have the reputation for observing all the rules and regulations concerning purity. And finally, number six, V'yal Yekoneis Bachrim of the Beis HaMedrash. He should not be the last one to enter the Beis HaMedrash.
Good rule.
Okay, now the Gemara is going to explain this a little bit more, but first they also mention that there are two other things, okay? The Yesh Omrim, and there are those who say also, Ap lo yapsia psir gadad gad. So he should not step with a long step, literally, psir gaso, or a common step. In the sense, the average person is expected to walk, slowly, pamelech, and so on and so forth, or the ordinary way, but he should not, take extra long strides. We'll find out why. V'yad yehalech. And the last thing is that he should not go out bekoma zekupa. He should not go out literally with an erect posture. Why not? So we'll see that too. All right. Mm-hmm. So now that we've been patient and we read this text, now we're going to see what the Gemara has to say about what are the reasons for all these things that they tell you not to do, that a Talmud Chacham should not do. Okay? Remember, of course, we're talking about the Talmud Chacham, but naturally, if a person feels that he's a Talmud Chacham in his own right, so then he should also abide by some of these rules as well. All right, so the first one was concerning going out levusam, right? Which, as we translated, means perfume, smelling of fragrances, okay? Okay, so the question is, why not? So Rabbi Abba said in the name of Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, he said, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, and then in turn he quoted Rabbi Yochanan, who said, B'makom shechashudim al mishkav zochor. He says, a man should not go out with fragrance or perfume in a place where they suspect that homosexuality is prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as if, right, yeah, obviously there were areas, I mean, where people were, you know, were they were suspected of being gay, which is
feminine.
Right. The truth of the matter is, don't forget, I mean, the Greeks had a reputation for being that way, many of the Romans had a reputation for practicing homosexuality. So, while Jews, you know, to us, it's absolutely an abomination. The Torah calls it that, you know, it's a Torah Ivor. And we use other expressions, you know. It's something which is absolutely abhorrent to us. But what if a person, for example, lives in an area where you have mixed, you know, Romans, Greeks, or whatever it may be, as well as Jews who were living over there, and they're, you know, the people on the lookout in order to form homosexual liaison. Okay? So therefore, a Talmud Chacham, he says, should not go out, you know, perfumed, because he's liable to get into a dangerous situation. Omer Rav Sheshes. So Rav Sheshes qualifies this, and he says, Lo amoron ela bevigdo. So, no, he says, the perfume should not be on his garment. In other words, he shouldn't take his garments and spritz perfume on them. All right. Ela begufo, abol begufo, zeyom abole. However, if he puts it on his body, then in that case, the sweat is going to dissipate it. So if he wants to do it in order to smell a little bit cleaner, you know, it shouldn't smell so much of BO or something like that. So eventually it's going to be dissipated by the sweat of his body. So in other words, according to Rav Sheshes, it would be permissible. Okay. Under those circumstances, but not to put it in his garments. Omar Rav Papa, Rav Papa, of course, adds something. He says, Usa'oro kivigdo dama. He says, if you spritz it on your hair, it's as if you're putting in your clothing. In other words, it is prohibited because it'll lead people to suspect you with something that you shouldn't be suspected of. The army law, but there are those who say, there are those who say, no, putting it on the hair is the same as putting it on the body. In other words, eventually you're going to sweat it off, and so therefore it's not so compelling. Okay. Now, how it would apply today, I mean, to such things as eau de cologne and things like that.
Or
no,
you have to shave lotion.
You draw your own conclusions, okay?
Well, since none of us are Tamil,
we're not Tamil Chacham, you don't have to worry, right? However, if you think that you're great Tamil Chacham, then you have to be more circumspect. All right, so that was the first thing that it said, you know, that it's a disgrace for Tamil Chacham to do. And what is the second thing? Second thing was, we are Yetze Yechidi Balaylo Mishum Chashore. You should not go out alone at night because of suspicion. What is the suspicion? So Rashi puts it in one word. He says Znus. In other words, if a guy goes out alone at night, he leaves his wife and his house behind him, and he goes out alone at night, it looks like he's looking for a little sexual adventure. And therefore, Talmud Chacham, needless to say, should not go out where he comes on the suspicion or something like that. But again, it's qualified. The lawyer Morani says, when are we talking and when do we say that he should not go out at night because of the suspicion? That's when he doesn't have a regular appointment to sit, you know, to go and to learn with his rebbe. If, however, he has a regular appointment to go and learn with his rebbe, then in that case, then everybody knows if he's going out alone at night, it's only because he's going over to his rebbe's house and he's going to go there and to learn Torah. So there's no suspicion now, and that would be permissible. So you see, if you go out, even if you come by yourself on a Wednesday night over here, no suspicion.
No suspicion at all.
Right.
That doesn't qualify if you come by car.
No. That's one thing you don't have to worry about, although people have used cars to get into all kinds of problems.
So you have to feed the camel.
Think about Tikkun Shavuot.
Yeah.
You were explaining to your wife why you're going to fall out for the entire night.
Right.
You don't come home until after daybreak.
Yeah. Well, if you remember, we learned something else last week about something along similar lines. We learned at that time, remember, the question is that if, for example, you know, you have a torch, so he said at that point that if you carry a torch with you, then in that case it's as though you're traveling two already.
With another person.
Right. And if, let's say you go out and there's a bright moonlit night which shines and lights up the entire area, then in that particular case you don't even have to worry. It's as if you had two companions with you. And the mazikin, as we saw, they're not going to go out looking in order to create problems for you, because you're well protected under those circumstances.
Well, I don't understand. You mentioned mazikin last week too. But
yeah,
I thought it was sacrilegious to believe in things like ghosts in mazikim,
okay,
and so on.
All right.
Why do they mention it in the Talmud?
All right. So I know I was asked this question last week, and I explained at that time, okay, that a rationalist such as Rambam, you know, the Maimonides, obviously did not believe in Shadim and Mazikim and things like that, and so he didn't believe in them. Demons and all kinds of evil creatures that are out in order to create problems for you, okay? But the masses, it's a different story. They believed in it, right? And since the masses believe, among the masses you will also find, you know, some Chachomim who also went along, I mean, because they also believed in it. Tell you the truth. I've come across Hasidim, for example, who to this day also believe that there are such things as Mazikim and Shadim and things like that. So, because their tradition is not necessarily the rationalist tradition. And if you study Kabbalah, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about the beauties of the Kabbalah, but I'm talking about the fact that there are, you know, certain types of Kabbalistic learning also involves trying to manipulate Shadim and so on and so forth, or trying to protect you from Shadim and things like that. Okay? So, under those circumstances, naturally, since many people believe in it, including some of the Chachamim, so therefore they speak about these things. Alright. In this case, of course, as we said, it's because you want to protect your reputation. This is the basic reason why. Here we're not talking about the Mazikim, but we are talking about you have a reputation to uphold. I mean, it's the old problem, you know, a Jew who is a religious Jew, when he gets caught doing something he has no business doing, I don't have to tell you. It's not only a disgrace for him, but every one of us.
Well,
we
sure,
feel
sure.
It. There's no question. All right. Then the next thing that they said, the Yad Yesev Yinolim Hametuloyim. Okay, do not go out with shoes which are patched. So he says, B'sayilel Rabbi Chiya Barabo, Adom Rabbi Chiya Barabo. It says this statement. It helps another statement, or it helps us to understand a statement made by Rabbi Chiya Barabo. who said as follows. He says, "Gnai hu l'talmid chacham." It is a disgrace for a talmid chacham. Sheyeitse b'nimlim ham tuloyim, who should go out? If he goes out with patched shoes. So, Aini, isn't it so? Ho rabchia barav novik. Hey, you say it's a disgrace, but the barav did go out with patched shoes. So how do we explain the fact that here he is quoted on the line just above saying what? That it's a disgrace that he should go out with minolim mituloyim, in other words, shoes that are patched. And here we see that he himself went out wearing patched shoes. So Rab Zutra, Pered Rach Nachman, so Rab Zutra, the son of Rab Nachman, explained, he says, Bitlai al gabe tlai. This is where you put one patch on top of another patch. In other words, the shoe is so old that you keep on patching it, so then it's already a disgrace. But not only that, he says, V'lo amaron, you know also what we are referring to? We're referring to Elo bepinto, avol begildo leslanbo. Now the pinto, this, as Rashi explains, this is the upper part. So obviously, if the patch is going to be found on the upper part of the shoe, everybody will see it. And if you put one patch on top of another patch, then obviously, a Talmud Chochem should not go out wearing shoes of that type, okay? But if it's Begilda, which as Rashi explains, is the sole, if you take a look at Rashi, you'll see that he's almost talking English over here. You see, Gilda, he says, Ekev, in other words, the heel, Shekorin, Sula. Of course, in French, it's soul, and so on. In other words, it's all French for the soul, okay? And from this word, by the way, you get the French word soulier. If you studied French once upon a time in antiquity, you remember soulier is the French word for shoes. Okay? So, if the patch is on the bottom, then we're not concerned. Why? Because it's not obvious. It's there for protection, but it's not obvious. And then they say, Vipinta. And how about in the upper part where we said that it's a disgrace to have patch? Says Lo Amoron El Biyurcha. Says it's a disgrace only if he goes out in the street, literally on the way. Avol Bevesa. But if he only wears it around the house, then less than bo. Then we're not concerned about that. It's no different than going around, let's say, old tattered
house shoes
or something like that, exactly.
Slippers,
exactly. Okay, it's the same thing. V'lo amoron, and then there's another qualification. Besides which, he says, when do we say that it looks disgraceful? Ela b'yamos hachama, those in the, during the time when the sunny season of the year. In other words, when it's not the rainy season. Okay, because then it's obvious. But avol b'yamos hakshomim. What if it is during the time of the year when the rain falls? Then in that case, less lumbo, then it doesn't matter to us. Why? First of all, he's entitled to wear. And secondly, your shoes are going to get somebody anyway. They're old. They didn't have the kind of pavements that we have or sidewalks such as we have. So, you're walking in dirt. And dirt, I don't have to tell you what happened. When you have a good soaking rain, it turns into to blot, as we say in French, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in that particular case, it doesn't matter. All right. Now, what was the next thing that they said? They said, V'yal yisapir misha bashuk. A person should not indulge in conversation with a woman in the marketplace, which, as I explained to you, means in any public area where he's going to be seen. Omer Rav Chisda, Rav Chisda says, "Afilo hi ishta." Now Rav Chisda says, even if it's his own wife, he should not indulge. Why? So as Rashi explains, you'll see a couple of lines near the end over there. He says, "Afilo hi ishta." He says, "She'ein hakol makirin bo v'choshtin also," because not everybody knows that she is his wife, and therefore they're going to suspect him of talking to some strange woman. Okay. Tanya, yes. Well, that's a good question. Of course, the answer is that in those days they didn't wait, right? I mean, in those days, for somebody to be a bachelor was considered a big disgrace, and they tried to marry off their children as soon as they possibly could. Right?
Interesting how this has evolved.
Yeah,
the whole line of reasoning. is for to keep the Talmud Chacham elevated.
Right, and above suspicion, exactly. It's a question.
But that he should obtain that particular position in the eyes of the community.
Right, right.
And also to set an example for the rest of the
community. Set an example, and also that he himself has to lead an exemplary life, whereby, I mean, he shows that what he is teaching others, he himself is practicing. Right. Correct, right. Yes. Yeah, Batel, right. Batel Medivre Torah, right. You know what happens to him in the end? Yeah, Sofo Yoresh. Correct, okay. It's a quotation from Pirkei Avos, right. Right. First chapter we find, I mean, it also says, you know, the Alt HaBesichim, he says, don't indulge in too much conversation with a woman. And then the qualification says, Beishto Amru Kavachomer Beishas Chavev. If we say that don't spend too much time talking to your own wife, all the more you shouldn't spend too much time, you know, talking to other women. And one of the basic reasons is because you're bottom of the Divrei Torah. In other words, the time that you should have spent learning
Torah,
doing mitzvahs and things like that, you're wasting that time by spending it too much in idle conversation. Of course, I mean, it doesn't mean that you're not allowed to talk to your wife. Needless to say, there are always things that have to be discussed with the wife. And
especially when she says one thing.
Not only that, look. You know, the Mishnah in Yomar, the Torah tells us about the high priest on Yom Kippur, you know, that it's written over there, the Chiper Ba'ado Uva'ad Beiso, right? He has to atone for himself and also for his household. And subsequently, it also says, Avad Kol Kal Yisrael, and also on behalf of the entire community of Israel, entire congregation. So, how do they explain the word Beiso? They say, Beiso is a Vishnu. In other words, when it says for his household, it means his wife, because of the fact that a person should be married. And who is the one who is really keeps up the pillars of the home, so to speak? It's his wife. And so therefore, there's no question, I mean, that a man definitely has to spend time talking with his wife, helping her and things like that. There's no question about that. But the question is, of course, to what degree, and whether is it idle chatter? Is it lashon hara? What are they discussing? So, this is something also to... to think about. Okay.
Well, since it was not the custom for women to study Torah in those days,
yeah,
I suppose that the rule would apply that you have very little conversation with your wife.
All right. Actually, there are two ways to look upon that. One is, of course, the fact that, of course, the woman was probably busy at home, taking care of children, preparing meals and everything else, and they're doing everything that a balabasta was expected to do. But in addition to that, you have to remember that while many women perhaps did not receive a formal education, they certainly got plenty of informal education, not just, you know, as relating to being a housewife and a mother and so on, but practical dinner, because they were in the final analysis responsible for the kashrus in the home, for the lighting of the candles and for many, many things.
Services, holidays,
right,
and so on.
Exactly, no question about that. So they certainly got plenty of informal education. We should not assume that women were ignorant. They were not ignorant, but they didn't get the formal education. And then, of course, I mean, this is a story, you know, that continued, you know, how much education did women get? Obviously, there were women who were better educated than others. For example, the wife of Rabbi Meir, Beruria, was a highly educated woman who was able to dispute and question, you know, the Talmidei Chachamim. As, for example, we had way, way, way back in the first chapter, how she interpreted the verse in at the end of Borchi Nafshi, Yitamu Chatoim in Ho'oretz, right? which means there's a story over there. Remember that Rabbi Meir was bothered by banditen in the neighborhood over there. They were always tormenting him, and he wanted to curse them to so that they would stop their tormenting him. And she said to him, "Don't pray for that. The verse doesn't say yitamu chatoyim in the sense of let sinners come to an end, but rather yitamu chatoyim means let sin itself come to an end. When sin comes to an end, then all these people will be converted from tormentors and from enemies into the people who love you and admire you and respect you." So that this is what we should be praying for, she said. Well, obviously she was a very well educated woman in order to be able to make these things, and of course the Talmud quotes her on other occasions as well. And we have quotations also, you know, to show about the remarks made by women and so on. So we shouldn't assume that the picture is all black. Now, of course, our own problems today, we're living in a different age, no question. While, let's say, a woman 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 100 years ago was able, you know, to absorb Yiddishkeit from the moment that she became old enough to see what her mother was doing, what her sisters were doing, and so on, what her bubby is doing, and, you know, she understood these things, and she knew, and the practical halachas that involved the woman. You know, they learned these things, okay? But we're living in an age where we no longer have that atmosphere, the sviva, as we would say in Hebrew, you know, the surroundings, the environment. We don't have it anymore. And this family is why to us, right, and we don't even have families today. This is another tragedy. So the fact is that for us, education is very, very important.
The woman who says, "I don't want to belong to Kadim, I want to belong to Bethel."
Absolutely.
"I don't want to sit alone."
Yeah, I want to sit with my husband, sure. Yeah.
So there's certain things, and she's the one that's carting the kids back and forth, you know.
Right. No question about that. Yeah, that's one problem. Of course, the other one is the fact also that there are so many broken families today.
Divorce.
Right. It's a result of divorce. That,
or no family.
The kids don't know
no father,
who the father is. They have no models. Many. Yes, David.
When did the situation or tradition about that you see now in the state of Israel, where you have many, many women's yeshiva?
Yeah. This is a phenomenon that started, I would say, with the Beis Yaakov movement. I spoke about that a few weeks ago. I mentioned that this started roughly maybe about 70, 80 years ago, not more than that, okay? And at first there was opposition also to it. So, you know, people were saying, it's studying, it's pastish. But she convinced some of the great rabbis of the time that what she was doing was right, and the movement caught on. Today everybody sends their daughters to a Beis Yaakov or to the equivalent.
So who is responsible for the start of the Beis Yaakov?
Her name was Sarah Shanira. She studied in Poland. Right?
Sarah Shanira?
Right.
Are they teacher training institutions, or are they
more than that? You know, from elementary right through teacher training, right? Mm-hmm. What they call the Beis Medrash or Mechlala, they call it. They have different names that they call it.
Stern College.
Well, Stern is something else. This was thought as an offshoot of the Yeshiva University, because women, you know, were getting more and more, were going to colleges, and they felt the need for a school where they would be able to combine both secular and the Judaic studies together.
They come out of there a double major, Judaic and whatever else they major
in. Right. And of course it has the equivalent, let's say, in the seminary where you know, for many years there's been either the Teachers Institute or the Seminary College. Now they have changed the names. Since everybody gives guilt, they change the names.
Yeah.
Like the Ivan Bosky Library.
I got it.
But, you know, they had this business of a double program, which they run together with Columbia University, whereby you can go to Columbia and take courses, and at the same time, you know, you can take courses at the seminary. So, you know, they too do the same thing. Then you have a school, because of the success of Yeshiva University, so you have Touro College.
Touro.
Right, which is a co-ed college. But, you know, its emphasis is still, you know, quite orthodox in the way it is. And of course, in Israel, there is the Bar Ilan University, which is also has a religious orientation, unlike the, you know, the secular universities like the Hebrew University or Tel Aviv University and so on. Although I don't want to imply that, you know, only Goyim go to those schools, because I have plenty of religious people who also go over there. But I'm talking about the philosophy of the school, that those schools are, right, those schools are secular in nature. No, they could give courses in Talmud too, you know, courses in Bible, courses in Talmud, and things like that. But the approach is different, and, you know, what are they aiming for, you see, is different. In one case, it is being taught as a subject on the same basis as something else. Another one is being taught because it's learning for the sake of learning, see, which is a different attitude. All right, getting back to our text. So far we've covered some of these things, right? All right, mm-hmm. Now what is the next thing that we were warned? Okay. Yeah, so when Rav Chisda said afilo hiyishto, even if it's his own wife, so Tanya nami hocha, so we have a similar tradition which says afilo hiyishto, even if she is his wife, or afilo hibito, or even if she is his daughter, afilo hiachoso, or even if she is his sister. Why? Lefishen hakol b'kin b'krobosov, because not everybody in the marketplace who sees him talking to a woman knows exactly who his women relations are. Yeah. All right. Now the next one, the Yisobach Chavu Boroshal Meiros. Why shouldn't he dine together? You know, associate together with Amar Haaretz, and you know, dine and enjoy meals together with them. My Tama, what's the reason? So the answer is Dilma Osilam Shuchim Asvayu, because perhaps he'll be enticed to follow their way of life. In other words, let's say if you know the Am Haaretz, you know, is not particular, and let's say maybe he likes to sit down and play cards after the meal or something like that. So the Talmud Chacham, if he's not strong in his own convictions, may think, hey, I like this.
Follow the Yitzhar.
Right, follow the Yitzhar. Right. Okay. And why shouldn't he be the last one into the base medrash? Very simple. Because they're going to call him a sinner or a transgressor or something like that. And I don't have to tell you, it's pastish. He should try to be the first one into the base medrash.
Why will they call him a sinner or a transgressor?
Because they will say very simply that this guy is too lazy to get up
on time
and become on time. Exactly.
Oh boy.
Well, as Rashi says, by the way, Rashi simply says that Poshe over here, take a look next to the last line, you see one word says Misatzel, they'll call him lazy. Okay, so if you wish, call him negligent. Okay, you don't like the word transgressor or sinner, so he's a person who's negligent, doesn't make it his business to be there on time. And then if you remember the two other statements that were made, that it's genai, it's also, it's not right. Aflo yafsiya psir katana, he shouldn't step, you know, with a long stride. Why? The Amamar, well, because there was a tradition made by one of the sages who said, psir gatso noteles echod mitak mima or enov shalodam. Says that if you take long steps all the time, long strides, so it takes away one Tak is 500. In other words, 1/500th of the light of the person's eyes. In other words, it diminishes your strength by that much. Okay? Why? Well, because in those days, I'll tell you the truth, they worked hard. They didn't have to say, now you better get out and take a walk because that's the best exercise for you or something like that. Living in a different age, I mean, they didn't need these admonitions. So if a person was rushing, And obviously it meant that he was exerting himself physically, and physical exertion is going to eventually weaken. This was what they believed. Of course, today our smart doctors tell us that, right, that physical exertion is good for you.
Is that an abbreviation, the mem?
No. The mem from tak. Tak is an abbreviation. Tak, you know, in numbers, tav is 400, and kuf is 100. So tak is 500.
Okay.
You know, the Hebrew alphabet, how many letters do we have? We have 22, all right? So good. From Aleph through Tes, we know that that stands for, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yud is 10. So if you make it Yud Aleph, Yud Beis, etc., so it gives you 11, 12, and so on. All right. Chof, therefore, becomes 20. Lamed is 30. Mem is 40. Nun is 50. Samech is 60. Ayin is 70. Pei is 80. And Tzadik is 19, right? But Kuf, that's 100. And then what do you have to do? So then you have to make combinations again. Okay? Yeah, like Kuf Aleph would be 101, or Kuf Chaf Dalet would be 124, and things like that.
Nice.
So, all right, good. Now, what comes after Kuf? The answer is Resh. So how much is Resh? Resh is 200. Okay? And Shin is 300. And Tav is 400. But what are you going to do after that? What if you want to say 500? So in that case, the usual thing is to take the largest letter first, and then whatever else follows. In other words, Tav being 400, and Kuf would be 100, therefore that makes 500. Right.
400 and 100?
Right. If I wanted to make 600, then what do? It's Tav. No, and it's Tav and Shin.
200.
Tav and Shin.
Shin, yeah.
Right. No, not tough and shit. Tough and Resh. That gives me 600. Tough Shin, that gives me 700. And then, of course, tough, that would be 800. And then again, it would be tough, Kuf.
Tough, Kuf.
Right, for 900. Tough, Resh, that would be 1,000.
Let's not go beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're doing that. Of course, for 1,000, also, they have another way. They'll say, for example, Aleph, all right, and the writing, it would be like Aleph Aleph. In other words, you know, 1,000. Then Beit Alofim, that would be 2,000, and so on and so forth.
Alofim,
but Alofim, the plural of the word Aleph, 1,000, right?
The system might be the wrong number.
Yeah, yeah.
Same idea.
Right, it's the same idea, right? An M, and an L, and a D, and a C, and so on and so forth. Exactly.
Do they use those numbers on Israeli money, on higher denominations?
You know where we use it. We still use it, first of all, for dates.
Yeah?
Yeah, we use it for dates. That's what we use it for.
No, but I'm talking about the money system.
What do you mean by that?
I say, do they use that system for counting money, for instance, in the Israeli banks?
Well, in the Israeli banks, they don't do it by Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet. So no, what they do is they use the same numerals that we do. Of course, today they're all using
English
computers
numbers.
And things like that. Yeah, it's the same thing. They're using the same IBM machines and
Arabic.
So on. That,
Arabic numbers.
No, they don't use Arabic numbers.
Oops.
Even the Arabs are learning how to use American numerals. But that's what they use in the
Bible. They are Arabic numbers, that's right.
Some say that in reality it was the Hindus who invented it, and the Arabs transmitted it, and so on and so forth. If you ever take a look at Arab numbers, you'll see that some of the numbers do not look like our numbers.
Okay.
All right. But at any rate, that's the way it works. Now, where do we still use? We use it for dates, primarily. For example, what is this year in the Jewish calendar? It's Tav, Shin, Nun, Beis. All right. Tav is 400. Shin, as we found out, is 300. So in other words, that means we're 700.
Right.
Nun is 50, and Beis is 2. So it's 752. And of course, what is understood is 5,752. Okay. All right. There's a possibility that they still use it. But, for practical purposes, business, commerce, or school, math, and things like that, they're using the same numbers that we do. Yeah. But they say it in Hebrew. Okay. So they say, Mai takante, lahadre bigadusha devei shepshe. So he says, how can he get back the strength that he lost? So the answer is, lahadre, let him seek after the kedusha, to recite the kiddush, the veishimsha, which we recite on Friday evening. Veishimsha is like, you know, benash bashas, in other words, the Friday night, you know, and we make kiddush. So if he makes kiddush, the light comes back to his eyes, okay? So you feel like a new man, you feel better after doing this.
True too.
Yeah. Okay, by the way, since there's a little aside, you know that on Shabbos we're not allowed to walk Basio Gasa, okay?
Yeah.
Not allowed to take long strides, but we should only walk, you know, Pamelach on Shabbos. However, that is qualified to us. You see, a lot of these statements, you find qualifications, okay? Qualification is that it's permitted, for example, to run, I don't mean run, but I mean to hurry in order to get to shul on time.
That is back.
Right. But walk slowly back. Right.
Well, you're running to a mitzvah, right?
Exactly. Right.
You're allowed to run to a mitzvah,
yeah, right?
Right.
Right.
So we just
right.
learned that.
Of course, we learned that yesterday.
Be the first to arrive and the last to leave.
Right. Okay. And then finally, how about the other one? The Alech Bekomos Kufo. The person shouldn't walk, you know, erect, literally with an erect stature. The Omar Mar, as a sage taught us, he says, Hamahalech Bekomos Kufo Filo Arba Abos. If someone walks this way, even four Abos, it's ki'ilu dochik raglechon. It's as though he's brushing against the feet, literally, of the Shekhinah. The Chsiv, concerning, you know, God's presence, is malochol etz kvodo. The entire earth is full of his glory. And so, if he walks erect, it's as though he's brushing. How should a person walk? Then he should feel a sense of submission to God. This is essentially what we're trying to say. He should feel a sense of submission, and therefore, our sages recommend that you walk with your head bowed slightly to show that you are submitting yourself to God's divinity. Okay.
Not to walk with your nose in the air.
Yeah, which was considered haughtiness. I mean,
right.
you have to realize that, right? In other words, it's the mark of a Baal Gaiva, so to speak.
Oh, right. Right.
Somebody who is full of proud, he's proud of himself or something like that. You know, the word pride, it's a funny word. Usually when we use pride today, we speak of it, you know, in the sense that it's a good thing to have pride, right? How about the word proud? Well, proud could also be good, but at the same time, proud sometimes implies haughty or something like that. Depends on how to... So now, what we're talking about over here is that it should not seem that a person is haughty, because he should be willing to recognize that God is above him. Okay, now we start the next page, Mem Dalad. And the Mishnah starts by saying, Hebiyu lefonav maliyach, techila, ufas imo, neburach ha-maliyach, ufotir es ha-pas. All right. Situation is as follows. They bring before him salted food to begin with. And together with it, they bring bread. Naturally, what is the bread doing over here? The bread is doing in order that they should be able to take the salt food and be able to, you know, to digest it. So, in this particular case, what do you make a bracha for? So the answer is, Mevorech al ha-maliyach. He has to make the bracha for the salted food that he's eating. But ufoter es ha-pas. And then he does not have to make the bracha for the bread, because the bread is only there to help him digest. It is not there as a main course.
But doesn't he have to make a motzi?
Under these circumstances, they say no. Now, what could you compare it to? The answer is like an hors d'oeuvre, as we saw before, okay? Do we have to make a bracha, you know, hamotzi for a d'oeuvre? Well, there's a difference of opinion about that, but nevertheless, one opinion follows what we have over here in the Mishnah, which now sums up by saying, all right, first of all, poter is hapas, right? He doesn't have to make the bracha for the bread. Sha'apas feilolo. because the bread is in this case only secondary to the
salted
food that he's eating. Okay. And zehaklal, and then they sum up by saying this is the general rule. Okay? Kol shehu ikar, whatever is the important food, the imot vela, and together with it you have something which is only secondary to help out, and in that case, mevorech al ha'ikar, he makes the bracha for that which is the important food to him, ufoter es ha'vela, and then he doesn't have to make the bracha for the other food which is secondary to it. Okay? So here we learn, you know, an important rule again, which we've had occasion to see before and which I've spoken about before.
Right.
For example, question with hors d'oeuvre. If the bread is only incidental to the hors d'oeuvre, I mean, in other words, what you're interested in is the anchovy or the
egg salad,
the egg salad or the whatever it may be, the sardines, maybe even the chopped liver. Right, and the only thing is only something upon which you put it, then in that particular case, you make the bracha for that. Yes, shahakal probably would be. And remember that shahakal is the all purpose bracha. You can't remember any other bracha. You say shahakal, yeah. I had a discussion with the rabbi several months ago, just before I started to cut out some sweets. If you have an ice cream cone, I felt that since I enjoy the cone, so first I make the bracha for the ice cream, after all it's the first thing I'm going to lick, right? And then when I get down to the cone, I should make a bracha of mezonos for that too.
Right.
He said, no, don't have to. Why? Because the cone, he says, is only there as a container for the ice cream. And so therefore falls into this category that we've discussed just now, that the principal food is the ice cream, right? And the other one being only secondary to it, in that case you don't have to make a problem.
So he was right.
So, fine. Okay. I'm arguing with the rabbi.
A thousand years from now, yeah, look at that.
If you have a hot dog on a bun, you are going to make the book on a hot
dog.
Technically, the answer is yes.
Yeah, we're right. Gonna,
but if you want to be, however, now let me say this, if on the other hand you want to fulfill everybody's strictest views, then in that particular case, it's more mitzvah in the case of the hot dog on the bun to make the bracha for the bun.
First.
Huh?
No.
To make hamotzi.
Yeah, no, you would.
But you don't have to. That's the point.
It's the main item.
I understand. I'm saying if you want to fulfill the strictest point of view, right?
If you're even extended this logic, you would wipe out all of our practices. For example, take a Shabbat meal. You're going to have roast beef and chicken, whatever. That the challah would not be an ikar either. You would never, if you're going to follow these principles of logic, be making hamotzi.
Okay.
Always be doing challah.
You're right, but of course we've learned that bread is very important to us, because what do we say about bread? We said it's misatzoid, in other words, it makes you zat, it sustains your life, and so on. This is real food, the bread. So that's why, you know, when we eat bread, we make hamotzi, as we already learned, then that'll take care already of foods that normally are going to be served together with it.
If you were having a hot dog, then you would take a piece of the roll first to make hamotzi first.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but if on the other hand, what if you just such a hackle for the whole thing? So you'll be yoitza.
Yoitza also.
Right.
Maybe not for the strictest sense.
Yeah, right. As I say, I mean, there are differences of opinion about some of these things.
Knowledge is not
combined.
Knowledge is for you. It actually opens up your sense by itself.
Yeah. I know one thing. It almost doesn't seem like a Shabbos meal without challah, except that we eat matzah too. Yeah, I like matzah.
That's the deepest in the ground, but we learned a little while ago that last time the guy had given a special.
Yeah, right, of course. Absolutely. Yeah. As we saw, they take precedence over all the other brachas too. Yeah.
But basically, if it's not a full meal and it's only an hors d'oeuvre, then you're going to refer
right.
back to the other.
The question is, is it a meal or a nash? This is really what it boils down to. If it's a nash, then in that case, you know, there's no question that the bun is only considered secondary. But if it's really you're making a meal over it, then in that case, you should wash and make a mozi. Yeah. What it boils down to. Okay? Now, The Gemara starts in by saying, "In the Yikor Midi the Hava Maliach Yikor Fasta Felon." So they want. So give me an example. They say where the salt food is considered the important food, and that the bread is only secondary to it. So Rav Acha Bereda Avir Omer Rav Ashi. So Rav Acha, the son of Rav Avir, said the name of Rav Ashi. He said that, yeah, there is. I can quote you an example. It says, "Beyochle Peros Ginosar Shon." We're talking specifically about a case where a person eats of the fruit that go around Yam Kinneret. Yam Kinneret, you know where it is. It's Israel, okay? Mm-hmm. The Goyim call it the Sea of Galilee. Mm-hmm. It's a Goyish name. Yeah. But we call it Kinneret, okay. And Gnosa is the area around it. As a matter of fact, there is also a kibbutz Gnosa where they raise all kinds of fruit over there. It's very rich soil, very fertile, and it produces also, it's hot over there, you know, it's already below sea level at that particular point, so that you can get a variety of fruits that, and they ripen 1, 2, 3 and things like that. So in ancient times they were already famous too. David?
No, I was just saying you were going to tell me about palm trees.
Yeah. So now we have a story to tell about how, you know, how come. It says, Omer Rabo Bachon. So Rabo Bachon said, Ki hava az linim basred Rabbi Yochanan, Echol Peres Genosar. Says, when we were following Rabbi Yochanan in order to eat these fruits of Genosar, the fruits of Kinneret, Ki havinin be meyo, when we were 100 of us in the group, Menachinin le lechol chad vechad asor asor. Then each one of us would present him with 10 pieces of fruit, each one of us. All right, so figure 100, right? Mm. Times 10, that is 1,000 fruits. Now, what is he trying to tell us? What he's trying to tell us over here is the fact that these fruits are so yummy, so delicious, that you know, you don't even notice that you're eating one after another. Yeah. Okay, so this is what he's saying over there. And he says, "Okay, Havinim be'asor." And when we were only 10 of us in the group, then Menachin and they called Chad v'Chad Meya. Then each one of us gave him 100 of these fruits. In other words, it brings us back again to the total of 1,000, right? V'chol Meya minayhu, and every and 100 of these fruits are the machzik leitzana batlosasoi, a basket. Tzana means basket, which normally contains three bushels or something like that. Was able to contain it, and not only that, you know, in other words, it contained a load of fruit, right? The yochelahu, and he would eat it, umishtaba, and then he would swear the lotoim ziyuna, that he still didn't taste food. So they say ziyuna salkatach. What do you mean food? Of course he had food. Eloheimor, but you should say mazona. He didn't have a meal. In other words, he still was not zot after eating so much of this fruit. That's how good it is. Oh. It's so tasty and everything else. But you know that this fruit is very, very sweet. And because it's so sweet, therefore what did they have to do? That's when they had to eat some kind of salty food in order to help digest this. This is the idea that we have over here. All right. Rabbi Bohu, this fruit is so good, they said that Rabbi Avohu would eat until his brow was so smooth as a result of eating this that a fly would fall down from it. Couldn't even the fly couldn't put the Rabbani Barabasi. Those two, he says, have a achle adenutur mazyehu. They would eat until their hair began to fall. I don't know what kind of a bracha this is. Today, of course, every man wants to have hair growing, not their fault. But nevertheless, this is how good it was. Yes, we'll say a kiddush, a kaddish rabbanim right now. Okay. All right, so to be continued next week. Kamiyosa Hashem. Do you remember those lines were on page Mem-Dalad, right?
Uh-huh.
And just to summarize for a couple of moments what we learned, and then we shall continue. Okay. the Mishnah says that Hevi'u lefonav maliach techilo lefasim oy demavarcham maliach upeita es hapas, right? The Mishnah says that if they brought him salted food and then there was also a piece of bread with it, then in that case he makes the bracha over the maliach, over the salted food, but upeita es hapas, he does not have to make the bracha over the bread. Because the bread, as we said, this is secondary to the salted food. Zehaklal, and then the Mishnah summarizes and says, this is the general rule, that kol shehu ikar v'yimot tefela. Whenever you have two things, one is the main food, and the other one is only, right, the ikar, and the other one is only secondary to it, then in that case, mevorech al ikar, you make the bracha over the ikar, over the, you know, that which is the primary food, and the poter is hatfil, and then you don't have to do it, you know, for the secondary. Of course, what is unusual about the case over here that they mentioned?
The fact that bread
is being served. Now, normally we would say that bread is the primary food, right? And therefore you make hamotzi, and as we already learned before, that if you say hamotzi, then automatically it's going to include everything which normally would be served as part of the meal. We did learn that if, for example, they served something at the end of the meal that you had not planned on, this, for example, a piece of cake or tofutti or something or other, and it was not in your mind at the at the beginning of the meal that you're going to be served something like this, then in that case you make a bracha for it. Okay, but of course you don't have to make a bracha after it, because when you say the grace after meals, that already is going to include everything that you had in the course of the meal. So
that will cover everything.
Yeah, everything that you wish in the course of the meal would be covered by the grace after meal. That's correct. So, as I say, you know, they serve you cake which you hadn't anticipated eating, or if they serve some other dessert that you had not anticipated eating, then in that particular case you make a bracha before. But if you knew that the menu contained all these things and you were expecting to eat all these things, then in that particular case you would be, I say, just with the hamotzi at the beginning.
So this implies that you have to know what you're going to eat at the meal.
To a certain extent, right, yeah. You should have a general idea of what you're going to eat. Yeah.
If, for example, you have a cup of coffee,
right,
you know, in the morning.
Yeah.
And you have another cup of coffee and another cup of coffee.
Okay.
How
yeah.
many brachas do you make? For if you have three cups, you make three cups.
Okay. The answer is there an interval between one and the other? For example, if I have a cup of coffee in the morning and then I decide that I want to have another cup of coffee immediately after it, then in that case, since I'm still sitting at the same table and you know, no great time has elapsed, so in that particular case, then it's enough with the one bracha that I made over the coffee that it also would take in the second cup of coffee. So that's one case. On the other hand, if let's say you have a cup of coffee and then general time lapse that they give you is 72 minutes. Okay? 72 minutes have passed, and then you decide that you have another cup of coffee. Then, in that case, you would make a separate bracha. But I would say, even if you had another cup of coffee a half hour later or something like that, when you had not planned on having a second cup of coffee within the 72 minute time space, then in that case, you make a separate bracha.
But if your routine is like two or three cups in the morning while you're working.
Right, correct. Yeah, then in that case, one bracha would really take care of it, provided, as I say, there's no great interval of time in between one and the other, and you have in mind, when you make the bracha, that this is already for whatever coffee you're going to have during the next, whatever space of time that is. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Suppose you are in a situation where you can't wash.
Yeah.
But you can only, maybe you can make a mosi, maybe you can't make a mosi, but when you finish, you can bench. Is that legal?
Yes. Yes.
It's legal.
It depends, of course, first of all, what you're reading, and secondly, under what circumstances. Okay. We learned a long, long time ago that in a place, for example, where it's hard to find water, then what did we learn you can do? And you're eating bread. Then in that case, you take the bread and you wrap, you know, you have a wrapper around it. Those days it would be like a napkin or something like that. It could still be a napkin, but you know, we could use a paper or napkin too. I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily a cloth napkin, okay? But if you don't have the opportunity to wash and you hold the this in a napkin, in other words, your hand is not dirty. It's not a dirty hand, so to speak. It's not coming in direct contact
with the food.
Right? Then in that case, you make hamotzi. And of course, you would bench afterwards. Okay? So that would be the general rule.
Okay.
If you were negligent and you didn't wash beforehand, and then you sat down, let's say, at the table over here,
you want to rush,
and you simply grabbed a piece of bread or something like that, and you wanted to bench with the group, yeah, you can do that too. In that case, it would be proper. Because even though, ideally, you should not eat anything without making a bracha beforehand and a bracha afterwards, but if circumstances are such that, you know, one or the other, it does not mean that therefore you shouldn't make any brachas.
Obviously.
Right. Okay.
But in case you forgot it,
yeah,
or whether you couldn't.
Definitely. Right. And we'll have a case along these lines this evening too.
Okay.
Yeah. In Yotzashem. All right. So this is what the Mishnah had to teach us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then the question that they raised is, if you remember, is there anything which is salted in nature? This is the first line of the Gemara. Would there be ikar mida? Is there anything? The havimoliach ikar, you know, where the salted food is the essential thing of astafela, and the bread is only secondary to it. How could we, in other words, conceive of a situation where this would happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then we have the answer given by Rabacha, Amar Rabacha Bereid Avira, Amar Rabashi, he said the name of Rabashi, he said, be ochle peros ginesa shana. Says that the case that the Mishnah is referring to over here, where the maliach is the more important and the pas, the bread, is the secondary, is a case where people have been eating these fruits that grow around the Kinneret. Ginosar is another name for the Kinneret region. Okay?
Right.
Yeah. There is a kibbutz Ginosar too, and so on. All right. Now, the area obviously is a very, very fruitful one, but the fruit also has very special qualities to it. And in the time of the Talmud, it was known particularly for the sweetness of the fruit. So outstanding that, as Rashi says over here, he says, Peros Kenosar, he says, Peros Eretz Yam Kinneret, right? He says, Chashuvim Min HaPas, they are more important even than the bread. But as we learn in the Gemara, why essentially did they eat? Okay, I mean, why essentially did they have to have salt food? The answer is, in order to counteract
the
sweetness of the fruit, because the fruit was so enticing, as we see in the first few lines of the Gemara, that we'll repeat again tonight, just to get the total picture. The fruit was so overwhelmingly sweet and yummy to eat, and you just couldn't seem to get zot eating it. I mean, eat one fruit and automatically you want to eat more fruit of it. It's so good that in order to counteract it, they had to have something which was salted in nature. But you can't simply take salted food with something or other. And so therefore, bread was eaten in order to accompany the salted food. David?
I'm wondering, in your research, is there any possibility that the Peros Kinosar is like the present day Sabar the
Sabra,
which is also sweet, and you can eat dozens of them at a time.
Yeah, I really don't know whether this is the case, because we don't have an exact description of what the Peros Kinosar are like. But the Sabra, we know that you have to peel away, and then you usually eat it together with the 5,000 pits inside of it, which is supposed to be good for the digestion, if you remember.
Eat it with the pits.
Oh, yeah.
Eat the pits.
Right. Yeah. Remove the skin, and then you eat the flesh with the seeds inside of it.
Where is that pomegranate?
No. This is, they call it a prickly pear or something like that in English. Okay?
Uh-huh.
But in Israel, it's called sabra. It happens to be both a Hebrew and an Arabic word. The Arabs also like it. In fact, a lot of Arabs like to sell it to the Jews. But it grows it grows like on cactus. If you've ever seen fruit growing on top of cactus, like out in the West, maybe,
you mean,
or Mexico.
It's a fruit of a cactus plant?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So that's what it's like. And it's a favorite.
Is it unique for Israel, or is it grown in other parts of the country?
I suspect that you may find it maybe in North Africa or some other areas, you know, where the climate and the soil is similar to that which you find in Israel. Yeah, okay. Yeah, and it's particularly true in the more sandy regions that they grow the in fact, it could grow wild, I mean, along the road too, you know. It doesn't have to be necessarily cultivated. But, you know, on the basis of that, this is why the Israelis who were born, the native-born Israelis, born received the title of Sabras, right. Because, as the popular adage says, you know, they're tough on the outside and sweet on the inside. All right. Now, let's take a look for a moment at Tosfos. Tosfos asks an interesting question. The very first one over there. You see, Beyotle Perskin Oseshono, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about a situation where people are eating the fruits of Genosa. He says, Shamaliach Ikar. He says, why is the salt food that is now served the more important than the bread? He says, Shehu bola hoshiv haleiv shenechnash v'neis mesikus hapevs. Says it's because this salt food is served in order to restore the heart which has been weakened by eating so much sweet fruit. And in this case then, the bread which is served, you know, together with it, it says it's tofel, it's only secondary. And it's only there, it's there only in order to accompany the salt food. So now, Tosfos asks the following question. It says, "V'yim toma," and if you would say, "Peiros have yikor umoliach tofel," why don't we say, says Tosfos, that the fruit that is the principal food, right, and the salt food, which is served subsequently, is only secondary to it. V'livrich, and therefore let us make the bracha al ha-peiros for the fruit. Let's make the bracha for the fruit. V'liftar kuhu. And then, you know, it would take care of all the others so that you don't have to make a bracha either for the maliach or for the bread, right? In other words, since this is the main thing that you're eating, the rest is only there in order to help you digest better.
Absolutely.
And make feel, you know, so you should feel better after eating something sweet fruit. So why don't we say just make a bracha with the fruits? So v'yesh loma, so therefore Tosfos suggests the following answer. Says the Maire, we're talking over here about a case, that he did not eat the fruit at the same time that he then had the salt. In other words, that salt dish was first served sometime afterwards. Okay? So that, and therefore, he says, inami, or another possibility, at the time when he ate these fruits of Genosar, he says, "Lo yoshamadai moliach ufas." There still was not any salt food or bread on the table. "Lo yoyodeya," because he did not know at the time when he started to eat the fruit, "sheyechlash libo," that his heart would feel shvach, right? Would feel weak, "machbas hamsikus," because of the sweetness of the fruit. So, because it was for a different time, that's why then the moliach becomes more important than the fast. But if he had eaten fruit and immediately eaten, you know, the salt and the bread, then in that case, since what is the principal food? It's the fruit itself, the peiros. So therefore, then the bracha for that would have already taken care of everything else. Okay? Honor Rabba Bar Chana, and now they started to talk about these peiros kedoshim. So Rabba Bar Chana said, "Ki havazin basved Rabbi Yochanan." He says, when we were following Rabbi Yochanan in order to eat these fruits of Genosar, when we were 100 in number, we would each give him 10 pieces of fruit. And if we were only 10, then each one of us would give him mayo. 100, each one of us will give him 100 fruits. So that, as you can see, it comes up to what? That he's eating how much? 1,000 fruits. Any case, right? They're called Neo Minayu, and every 100 fruits of this have a Masikul Hutsan about Flossasoy. you needed a basket. Tana means a basket, okay? A bushel basket, like. But you needed a basket which could contain bars, like Ben, same thing, right? Which could, you know, contain lots of soy, in other words, three so'ah, or let's say three bushels, in order to, you know, to fill this. So in other words, he ate a tremendous quantity of this fruit. The yochelahu, and he ate it. Kenanara, he was able to handle all this and to eat all this. Umishtaba, and then he would swear the Lord Toyim Ziyuno that he'd not tasted any food.
And he ate all 1,000 at once. I mean,
they kept on giving to him and gegessen and gegessen and gegessen. He ate and ate and ate and ate, and it was
now
so
he says
good.
He didn't taste
so
any food.
So, like me with a bowl of nuts.
What?
Say it's like me with a bowl of nuts. Put cashews or pistachios or peanuts in front of me.
And then you're gone.
I have to cut down on it. It takes willpower to cut down or to give it up altogether. But and, you know, you never feel zapped after it. You know, you still want more.
Sure.
Right. So the Gemara says, you know what you mean. Wasn't food, wasn't nourishment, sakadate. Eleva mazona. All right, now what is the difference between ziyuna and mazona? After all, we see in both of these words, what? You see the same root, right? Like mazon, zon, you know, this is the verb is, you know, lozon, from which we have azonis orlam, kulab tuvo, grohat varashem, azonis hakol, and so on, okay? This is the root idea. So what is the difference between them? So Rashi says, Ziyuna, if you take a look on the second line, the Rashi says, Mashma mide devar achil. That Ziyuna means simply something that you eat. In other words, he would eat all this fruit and still feel, you know, that he hadn't eaten anything, period. Whereas Mozono, this is devar hasoid. In other words, it's like a meal where you feel full after you have eaten. Okay? So, in other words, he ate, sure it was food, but he never felt that it was manzona. He still did not feel sated, you know, stuffed to the extent, you know, that he didn't want to eat anymore. This is how good they were. Rabbi Abohu. So now we have more stories about these parents. All right, what about Rabbi Abohu? He says, Ochila dehav shorek le'dudvor. This we had last week too, if you remember. Another one of the qualities is apparently that it makes the skin very, very smooth. So as a result, when Rabbi Abohu ate these peres genosar, a fly couldn't even stay on his brow, on his forehead, because
that,
of the fact, right, that it was so smooth that the fly couldn't grab hold. So that's another quality of the parents can also. Not only you can eat it by the dozens and not feel full, but also that it smooths your skin. Right, it gives you a smooth complexion. Okay? And then we have another maisa about this, and this is the last thing that we had. If you remember, Rabami and Rabasi have a achli of the Dotamaz Yehu. Rabami and Rabasi would eat these fruits until their hair began to fall out. Now, I still haven't figured out what's the glick about that, but but I guess it goes hand in hand with the fact that it makes your skin so smooth that
maybe it's also an maybe it's an idiomatic expression, you know.
Yeah.
People say it was so good it'll blow your mind, you know. So your hair will fall out, you know.
All right. Well, in any case,
we understand.
Right. It's good. That's all I can say.
We got the message.
All right. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Hava Achil Ademorit. He would eat until